here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. Today we have a quick roundup of new films and two or three classics. First off, here's a quick tour of some recent films.
We used to be able to get into a room with the enemy. Now they're just floating in the ether.
If we don't do this, there will be nothing left to save.
No Time to Die, in theaters from MGM, Columbia, and elsewhere in the world, Universal, is directed by Cary Joji Fukunaga, most famous, I guess, for HBO's True Detective, written by Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, who write most of the Bond movies, this time joined by Fukunaga and Phoebe Waller-Bridge. The cast includes, for the fifth time, Daniel Craig, Lea Seydoux, Rami Malek, Lashana Lynch as the new 007, Ralph Fiennes as M, Ben Whishaw as Q, which, by the way, stands for Quartermaster, Jeffrey Wright as Felix Leiter, Christoph Waltz as Blofeld, Ana de Armas of Knives Out as a agent Bond meets in Cuba. So the premise is that Bond has left active service and is living in Jamaica, but he's approached by his old CIA friend, Leiter, asking for help on a mission, which is to kidnap a scientist who has been making something called nanobots that have a peculiar way of killing others without destroying the host. It gets a lot more complicated than that. But it's rather startling to realize that Daniel Craig has made only 5 James Bond films. 8 films, Moore made 7, and Brosnan made 4. But in this modern age of over-advertising and the internet, Craig's presence is much larger. His casting was a response to the success of the Bourne series and other spy films, and they're less cartoonish than the Roger Moores. But the Craig Bonds have another facet. They resemble, in a way, the Marvel Universe films. They all tell one big story, are interconnected in many ways, and you really don't realize it until Spectre. Thus, to appreciate the new one, it's a good idea to watch the previous 4, or, lacking time, at least Spectre. And that way you're primed for a satisfying and surprising send-off, one that is often funny, laden with in-jokes and fan service, and unexpectedly moving. Craig's Bond was a rounded human being, still mourning the death of Vesper Lynd from way back in Casino Royale, and here finally putting some demons to rest. It's a little on the long side, but it seems as if in years to come, this whole sequence of films will stand as superior commercial entertainment of some depth and emotion.
Poker's all about waiting.
Check, raise, re-raise, call.
Then something happens.
You remember it?
This is where all the good stuff happens.
This is how it starts. Just a fleeting thought.
You might want a piece of what I'm gonna do.
Then it builds.
What is that?
Set things straight.
You know the phrase tilt? Just like a pinball. Any man can tilt. You can tilt.
Is it possible to know when one reaches the limit?
The Card Counter from Focus Features in theaters, directed by Paul Schrader and written by him, starring Oscar Isaac, Tiffany Haddish, Ty Sheridan, and Willem Dafoe, and it tells of William Tell, a gambler, who sets out to reform a young man seeking revenge on a mutual enemy from their past. Paul Schrader here dips into the well of his influences again with this film that starts out like a gambling mentorship movie like Hard Eight, but then turns into a redemption tale focused on the military sins of Abu Ghraib. The elements don't sit perfectly together, but at least someone is keeping the issue alive. The casting of some parts feels a little off, but Schrader's usual style is fine and clean, and he takes us into areas of America where real people work and live and play. The final images are lifted not just from his earlier American Gigolo, but from that film's source, Robert Bresson's Pickpocket, Bresson being perhaps the most influential filmmaker on Schrader's style and thought. Now, Jeff Godsell, down in Los Angeles, revisits an early film about one of Hollywood's greatest comedy directors.
1940 was a very good year for Preston Sturges. It was the year that he graduated from screenwriter to writer-director. And he's acknowledged as the first one who ever did that at a major studio. He would soon be followed by Billy Wilder, also at Paramount. And you could say that he certainly earned the right to give it a shot, having written The Good Fairy in 1935 for William Wyler and Easy Living in 37 for Mitchell Leisen. And as the year began, on January 1st, Remember the Night, also for Leisen, was released. Nevertheless, it was only when Sturges sold his next story, The Great McGinty, to Paramount for $1 or $10, depending on what story you read, that he was allowed, in return, to direct. And with The Great McGinty, Sturges was off and running in the greatest seven-picture, four-year run in the history of movies.
But there must be some way, some solution of mutual satisfaction. I don't know how to talk to a mayor, but if I could only persuade you that...
You can't persuade me, Mr. Maxwell, because it's entirely out of my hands. But I'll tell you what I'll do. Just for old time's sake, I'll send the chairman of the bus committee up, and if you can persuade him, it's all right with me.
Is he difficult to persuade?
Well, he probably ain't impossible.
As good as Sturges' previous screenplays were, it's still surprising to see just how good The Great McGinty really is. Dan McGinty is a drifter, a tramp. But he lucks out one day when, in a line for free soup, he's approached by some political hucksters to make a couple of bucks. All he has to do is go vote for their candidate, under a different name, of course. They'll give him a ticket, and he cashes it in for $2. McGinty sees an opportunity there, gets a list of names, and comes back at the end of the day with 37 tickets. That kind of opportunism impresses the local political boss, played with great flair by Akim Temirov. Despite the fact that the volatile pair are often ready to punch each other out, McGinty begins his steady rise up the political ladder of corruption. As an alderman, McGinty schmoozes with the ladies and plays hardball with the tough guys to get the protection payments that he needs from his clients. Part of the genius of Preston Sturges and what is so essential in comedy is making the implausible believable. And Sturges does this by making every individual scene ring true. Brian Donlevy has never been better as the big lug who rides this improbable wave to the top, next as mayor, and then to the governorship, before his inevitable downfall. Everybody has a part to play, and some of the best dialogue, and there is plenty in a Sturges script, can go to a supporting player. Sturges created a kind of stock company of character actors that appeared again and again in his films, like William Demarest and Jimmy Conlon. There are no mere expository or transitional scenes in Sturges films. Every one is an opportunity for a character to advance the story through a personal bit of business or a witty line. Sturges gets his actors to really buy into their parts. Donlevy can be seen doing all kinds of bits of business, sometimes unnoticed. Not characteristic of him in any of his other films, as good as he is. And has Joel McRae ever been better than in his two films for Sturges? Sullivan's Travels and The Palm Beach Story? A Sturges set was always a lively one with all kinds of pranks going on, but unlike those of Leo McCarey, where improvisation was always encouraged and sometimes made it onto the screen, you get the feeling that everything in a Sturges film, scripted or not, came out of that brilliant mind. Sturges was never known as a flashy director, dialogue-driven as his films are, but neither was he stodgy. Time and again, in The Great McGinty, there are subtle, almost invisible camera movements to help frame the actors for the action to come. So as McGinty rises in his political career and runs for mayor, it becomes obvious that to get the women's vote, the candidate has to be married. Romance is the last thing on his mind, his experience with dames being less than positive. His secretary, played by Muriel Angelus, an English actress in her last film role, suggests that a marriage of convenience would work, in name only, to her. That's agreed upon, and all around and the deed is done. All that's left is for her to reveal that she has two kids and a dog. The inevitable romance that gradually develops between them is beautifully handled and typical of the unconventional pairings that can be found in so many of Sturges' films. For McGinty, it also means a softening of his position that you can't fight City Hall. Influenced by his wife's urging him on to be the true reformer that he's led the public to believe he was, McGinty takes on the political machinery. When he becomes governor, he pushes back against his own bosses, thus hastening his own political demise. Sturges was a cynic at heart, who nonetheless celebrated the American entrepreneurial spirit in business and in politics, while lampooning it at the same time. He saw the corruption and hypocrisy as just part of the great American way of doing things. Perhaps that perspective came from his spending so much time in France growing up, a more continental approach to America. Sometimes he would have his characters undercut their own supposed moral positions. In the Palm Beach story, the rich, elderly Weenie King tells Claudette Colbert about his own hot dogs. Lay off of them, you'll live longer. And in The Great McGinty, as he's about to take on social issues like child labor laws, McGinty tells his wife about the time that he worked in a factory as a kid, wrapping taffy, that is, the ones that they didn't eat. And we liked it, he said. Sturges would win an Oscar for The Great McGinty for Best Original Screenplay, the first ever given. And it was an auspicious start for his string of 7 masterpieces. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And don't forget to drop into Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for more recommendations. And you are listening to Film 111 here on Community Radio, KBOO Portland. And now this membership note.
This is Professor Kitty from the Monday Sampler. Remember that this is listener-supported radio, KBOO in Portland. If this radio station is important to you, please go to kboo.fm/give to become a member. Now, back to Film at 11.
Next up is Britta Gordon on a recent film by one of South Korea's Big Three directors.
Claire's Camera, a film by South Korean director Hong Sang-soo, was apparently shot during the 2016 Cannes Film Festival and appeared in the Cannes Festival of 2017. I say apparently because, except for the fact that it concerns a film director and some of his entourage, you would never know that anything like the high, glamorous theater of Cannes is happening. The streets the characters move through are clean and empty. The well-lit alleys of ancient stone don't seem to lead to the modernist temples of tourism. There are no paparazzi rocketing around in smart cars. This is life in the eddies of big drama, in a film so quiet you begin to notice wall paint, lighting fixtures, and the exact shade of sandals worn by an actress.
Taking a photo is something very important, because if I take a photo of you, you are not the same person anymore.
So why talk about this film now? Well, for one thing, it's become available on Canopy, our library's free streaming service. For another, it might serve perhaps as a last goodbye to the warm weather concerns of summer, watching slender women waft their way through this seaside town before the darker Sturm und Drang of Halloween and Christmas releases begins. And when many of us still can't travel, it's an opportunity to hear other voices, other languages, refracted through the characters and us. In fact, the idea of refraction is a key theme throughout Claire's Camera. Refraction of languages, with the character speaking English, French, and Korean at various points, depending on who they're talking to. Refraction is a kind of reflected existence. The action takes place during the Cannes Film Festival, but you're only aware of this from some of the things characters say. Refraction of emotions, where a character will declare something and you watch the second character taking it in, throwing it back in a slightly different fashion. You don't always know the exact resolution of scenes. In fact, you won't be apprised of much of the context in which the characters live. The result is a film that feels both deft and ambivalent, light and a bit terrible at the same time. The film story is simple and simply presented. No close-ups or reverse angles or clever editing. It's a bit like spa food, with a result that you are very attentive to each word, each gesture. Claire, of the camera, is played by Isabelle Huppert, looking gorgeous in her yellow raincoat and sweater. She's accompanying a filmmaker friend, Khan. Having no other purpose, Claire wanders around town with camera in hand, seemingly open to everything and everyone. Man-hee, played by Kim Min-hee, is a young Korean woman who is abruptly fired by her boss, Nam, played by Mi-hee Chang, over tea at an outdoor cafe for being apparently dishonest. The content of that dishonesty is never discussed, and one is acutely aware of the guardedness of these two women addressing each other, great emotion deflected, delayed, each repeating the word honesty without taking on the specifics of what Man-hee has been dishonest about. Subsequently, these and a few more characters enact a kind of la ronde of echoing encounters. Nam has a beachside talk with a film director. It is clear that his film is the reason she's there, and it becomes clear that he has slept with Man-hee. Mostly shot from behind the characters, one notes Nam's continual laugh of anger as this indiscretion, his explanation is drunkenness, is examined. A bit later, Claire meets the aforementioned director, So Wan-su, played by Jin Young-jung, while sitting in an outdoor cafe, and offers to take his picture. They discuss why they are there. Director So is charming, curious, but not really flirtatious. Claire is warm, curious, and they talk about poetry, deciding to go into the local library. So says he would like to learn how to pronounce a poem. Claire pronounces the lines for him, then listens gravely, even severely, in best teacher mode, as he tries it out in French. Man-hee, having taken her shoes off and wandering the beach disconsolately, encounters a female filmmaker who tells her she's been invited by Man-hee's former boss to meet the director. In the course of their discussion, Man-hee not revealing that she has lost her job, the filmmaker exclaims, "It's so hard to make an honest film." The word clearly strikes Man-hee and the viewer, and she hurries away, sandals in hand. Soon after, she meets Claire in her wanderings, and they begin a discussion. Man-hee offers to cook a Korean dish for Claire, who agrees. To watch these two women meet each other is delightful, like watching two rare birds peck the air around each other and decide to join forces. It is not realistic, but it feels more ritualistic, not like stage drama, an old ritual in a new place. Director So and Man-hee's boss have a discussion at a cafe about the firing of Man-hee, the fact that he slept with her, the possibility of Nam's jealousy, and then, in a surprise turn, So's careful but determined request that they end their romantic relationship in order to preserve the business one. Nam proves a formidable interlocutor, never losing her composure as she absorbs this blow. Director So, as it is clear is his wont, continues to drink. Claire arrives and sits at the table with him, offering to take their photographs, asserting that by doing so they will be changed. Director So isn't quickly convinced. The film has an episodic, almost random structure, as if indeed the viewer were walking around Cannes and peering for a few minutes at a drama being enacted here and there. Some scenes have a delightful, I'm on vacation quality, and Huppert's warm, dispassionately compassionate performance seems a vacation from her filmic oeuvre of cool customers. But other scenes give surprising jolts of energy, as when Nam, after being jilted by Director So, laughs as she looks at a picture taken of her saying, "I'm still pretty," something he has said before, by the way, and attempting to woo him back on that score, a courageous and sweet break from her iron demeanor. Or, alternatively, when Director So, encountering Man-hee at what is clearly meant to be a Cannes soiree, starts to lambast her for wearing shorts, in other words, displaying her feminine voluptuousness without consideration for her soul. It's a breathtakingly brutal scene, ended only when So leaves to rejoin the waiting Nam, seen down below in her signature quotient of red. And when Claire and Man-hee, bathed in yellow clothing and sitting near a yellow wall, talk as Man-hee cuts up a pink cloth, an act of petty violence that she says makes her feel better, the scene, which has felt like a therapy session envisioned by Elle magazine, suddenly swerves in a different direction when Claire reveals her grief over the death of her boyfriend and the fact that she has had moments of considering suicide. I almost wanted to put this film into a new film sub-sub-genre, film candor, where things are apparently what they apparently are, where the lightest of stylistic veils, the careful use of color, the emptying out of scenery, the lack of violent drama, the conversational back and forth that emphasizes repetition almost as in therapy, dresses a series of encounters that, while courteous, while careful, while encouraging, well, that's Claire, seem almost ordinary, thus real, and yet still mysterious, or at least ambiguous. The title brings to mind Eric Rohmer's Claire's Knee, and there are certainly other aspects of the film that are Rohmer-esque, notably the way characters meet and talk easily, lightly, quickly. Part of that, of course, is due to Huppert's Claire, who is quick, non-judgmental, compassionate yet detached, decided but not vehement. Huppert plays someone who is out of her element, and thus free to be a conduit by which other people see themselves differently, come to terms with their own emotions and dramas. And yet, Rohmer's characters, for all that easy camaraderie and agreeableness, are, it turns out, fairly determined. And not only determined as in driven, but determined as in their fates have already been decided. The moralistic underpinnings of Rohmer's films, the director's own conservative and Catholic perspective, are, when you look at the totality of his films and of the fixedness of his characters' concerns, pretty clear. The fact that a teenager named Claire's Knee can subvert those concerns for a good filmic while are Rohmer's point, but no one gets off scot-free, and Rohmer often shows how ancillary or other loved ones to the protagonist pay the price for digressions from the strict path. By contrast, Sang-soo's characters are not as Rohmer's in their own context. And as such, the setting of an international film festival brings such context, such local fixedness into consideration and doubt. Claire's unbranded camera gives everyone a look at who they are, where they are, in that moment. Sang-soo may give director So a bit of a drubbing as a fallible soul using alcohol as the only way out of his current conundrums, but mostly everyone is treated with the same light touch, as assorted sea creatures who have washed up on this particular French beach and are carefully sounding each other out, knowing they will very soon wash away. When I said at the beginning that this can be a bit terrible, it's because the locality, the fixedness of filmic concerns, the reality of a place, is so central to so many great films. It's perhaps inevitable that a kind of indeterminacy creeps into the global filmmaking worldview. But you can't eat spa food forever, and at some point, everyone has to go home.
Thanks again, Britta. Finally, in our book corner, we look at a new monograph on one of the progenitors of Hollywood's cinema of paranoia, John Frankenheimer's Seconds. Seconds, released in 1966 and directed by John Frankenheimer from a novel by John Eli, adapted by John Lewis Carlino, was the third and final film in his Paranoia trilogy, which began with 7 Days in May and continued with The Manchurian Candidate. May still holds up beautifully, and Candidate is an odd film with its own pleasures, but Seconds was a difficult project that failed at the box office for reasons that Jez Conley and Emma Westwood address in their new monograph in the Constellations series from Liverpool, subtitled Studies in Science Fiction, Film and Television, from the firm which also publishes the Devil's Advocate series. For one thing, it starred Rock Hudson as the second iteration of a middle-aged banker recruited by a company that gives its clients a new lease on life. Those who wanted a Rock Hudson sex comedy were disappointed, and those who wanted a science fiction film didn't want to see Rock Hudson in it. As the authors summarize, if ever a film deserves a second life, it is Seconds, director John Frankenheimer's criminally overlooked monolith of bleak paranoia. Part science fiction of the speculative present persuasion, part proto-body horror, part noir thriller come black comedy, a film that is locatable at the thematic and stylistic intersection of the post-McCarthy mindset, European art cinema, the suburban identity nightmares of the Twilight Zone, and the midlife crises of malehood aroused by 1960s counterculture. Seconds is a film that pushes into parallel definitions and bullheadedly refuses to be described in 25 words or less.
Oh, you'll be self-conscious at first. Don't worry. It will wear off. And remember, you've got what almost every middle-aged man in America would like to have. Freedom. Real freedom.
They go on to note, a significant influence on Seconds preceded it by 10 years and can be found outside the genre. The man in the gray flannel suit, Nunley Johnson, 1956, based on the hit 1955 movie of the same name, written by Sloan Wilson, struck a chord and perhaps a nerve among America's middle-class male white-collar workforce with its story of the prototypical discontented businessman and the strain of executive conformity. It encapsulated a particular anxiety and, through its drama, raised the fundamental question on the mind of many a working man trapped in the mechanism of the American dream. Who am I? As the decades turned and the Cold War chilled, that managerial anxiety fused with the prevailing countercultural reaction to living in the shadow of the bomb, and a fresh version of that question came to be asked, who do I want to be? End quote. They note how much the film anticipates the 70s, but also the 80s. Quote, the idea of the shadowy organization controlling individuals without their knowledge would rapidly become a standard element of much science fiction cinema in the 70s and 80s, representing a growing awareness and dissatisfaction with ruthless, dehumanizing capitalism. Think of the spectacular optical corporation in Videodrome, Cronenberg, 83, Weyland-Yutani in Aliens, Cameron, 86, and Omni Consumer Products in RoboCop, Verhoeven, 1987. And you can see how the notion of the sinister corporation took off as the prevailing antagonist in the genre. For this author, to know seconds is to fully understand a fascinating and important cultural cataclysm that occurred in the mid-20th century, one that took place before she was born. Seconds acts as a capsule distillation of this seismic shift, in which patriarchy in all its guises, political, corporate, and social, experienced its own midlife crisis. And as a result, the very pillars of society became noticeably unstable. This is one of the best books on a single film that I've ever read, or at least read in a long time. For one thing, it is endlessly elusive and referential, shows wide learning and media understanding, constantly surprises, and makes fascinating connections. For example, they write, aside from the Saul Bass credits, Seconds shares with Psycho a narrative trajectory that can be likened to the human digestive system. Consider the post-credits opening sequence of the Hitchcock film, an aerial shot of the city of Phoenix that enters the mouth-like window of a hotel room and comes to rest on the sandwiches by the bedside of the lovers, Marion Crane and Sam Loomis, during their illicit lunchtime tryst. The symbolic mastification of this first love scene serves to break open and extract the film's starter exposition, the couple's passionate desire to be together, constrained by their lack of money, end quote. And then they go along to trace the alimentary elements of both Psycho and Second's peristaltic system. But then finally, they write, the means by which the company embroils its clients is a disinfected variation of the oldest profession. It is essentially a colossal, elaborate escort enterprise, promising physical, emotional, and, by extension, sexual freedom and pleasure, yet ultimately delivering torment and treating the customer as a commodity, pound for pound. The corporate costumes merge, executive suits, surgical scrubs, butcher's aprons. The business premises loop and interlace. Slaughterhouse, beach house, charnel house. Company clients are always usable body parts. From start to finish, weighed, measured, processed. There is so much more that could be quoted from this slim but dense book, one that makes you not only want to review Seconds, but the other Frankenheimers in the Paranoia series, but also re-see those from the 70s that it anticipated, such as The Parallax View, The Conversation, Night Moves, and so many more. Thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next week. So until then, keep watching the screens.
KBOO Portland. We'd like to thank everyone who has been donating during this membership drive. Don't forget, tomorrow is your last day to donate. Big thank you to Roberta and Stuart for your donations and making all of this possible.
Tune in to KBOO every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th for KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series. Join KBOO in celebrating and paying tribute to the contributions and enriching influences of Hispanic and Latinx Americans and their ancestors. You'll hear from volunteer producers from Buscando America, Boogie Pachanguero, Noticias en Español, and more. Again, that's KBOO's Hispanic Heritage Month series, every Friday at 6 p.m. from September 15th to October 15th. Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio.